Some time ago, here at Holden, someone said, "Why don't you just read your poetry?" And so I began to think about that and what would be the benefit of that. I could immediately think of one of the disadvantages of it, which is it makes me real nervous sometimes. Someplace around in the middle of it, I get to thinking, this is so self-centered, I can't stand it. But on the other hand, I really do believe that we learn about life from each other's stories. And that as I hear you tell your story, whatever portion of it I hear, I come to understand you better. And similarly, we are tied together by a greater story, the story of humankind, the story of God in history. And so all portions of that story are very important. So that's what I do, basically, tonight, is beginning with my earliest books, moving in sort of a steady stream. I just never did stop writing, telling my story in some poetry that I've written. My poems generally, my one son who says, "Oh, they never rhyme, Mother, they never rhyme." And he's kidding me because his don't either. But they sound more like conversation a lot. And sometimes they're more in a form of a prayer than a poem. So let's begin on a poet's journey then. I was born and raised in my early years in Wisconsin, near Milwaukee. My mother had a short life. She only lived until she was 42. But she was very important to me and a significant part of my life. And it was some years later that I wrote, "Mother had a very lovely face, a quiet voice. Her skin was somehow softer to my touch than any other. Suddenly, tonight I see it. She was kind. Her eyes were gentle. And her smile, how I did love to feel her smile upon me. She was comfort. I believe she really cared about me. Tonight she seemed so very present. She was too young to have died. Through my tears tonight, I miss my mother." It was a significant thing to have a mother die that young. I certainly not as great as a smaller child, but it changed my view of life a good deal, I think. And I think perhaps I've always been more aware of death than some. I was fortunate that two grandmothers lived in town, grandmothers and grandfathers at that stage. And they sort of, well, I can't say that they were substitutes, but they were there anyway. And one of them was Grandma Nelson, who lived to be 93. And the other, Grandma Engholm, Gina was her first name, was 84 when she died, both of them in 1980. So you see that they've been with me all that time. When I was a little girl, Grandma played piano and we sang. We sang of waves and nightcaps and of little birds and God. Yesterday, I held my grandma's hand. It is soft and vibrant, though she just turned 82. Yesterday, we talked together of the mystery of life and dying. Grandma knows that she will die. She's glad for her long life. But she says that somehow there's still so much to do. She squeezed my hand. She knows I love her and that someday I will miss her so. But because of Grandma, I have memories which sing of waves and nightcaps, little birds, and God. And every little wave had a nightcap on, a nightcap, white cap, nightcap on. Every little wavelet had a nightcap on, so very, very early in the morning. It's a funny little song. Gave me a lot of pleasure, though, to watch her play the piano and my little boys standing, then they were little, standing there singing with her. Real sense of continuity to life. And even to read that poem is a little hard right at first, but to read that poem at the at her funeral. To tie all of life together in that way, with relationship. I would visit the farm and perhaps they wondered why I came. I was afraid to ride horses fast, but I loved the hickory woods where horses went. I didn't have the gay abandon to enjoy the hayloft or the muddy fields, but I liked the house. The old brick house was strong. The back porch smelled of washing soap. The rooms were large. They echoed, and a mirror went from the ceiling to the floor. The kitchen was the best. People liked to be there, cooking, eating, talking. The people were the reason that I came. Their anger was loud, their kindness direct. Their laughter was long until we would have to leave the table in tears. Their love was real, it showed. And one day I looked up and saw across the table the brother who had been there all the time, the boy whom I first loved and kissed. He was smiling. Often I return to the shaded, quiet memories of the farm. So it was a rather fortunate thing that that book was published. I probably would never have written another word if it hadn't been. It was my first try. That never happens, by the way. That's just Cinderella. So we lived in Wisconsin until I was 10, and we moved to Minnesota. Lived in the Minneapolis area ever since that time in various places. Being a teenager was terrible. You probably know about that. Someone said to me he would never return to that age again, and I agree. Because one is so confused, and I can remember that this one was probably my biggest concern. Lord, if I could wish for anything, I'd want to be popular. I envy kids who feel confident, who date a lot, who know how to make friends and wear clothes. Sometimes my envy's near hate. I despise their successes. Lord, I wonder if I really hate myself, not them. I'm disappointed in the way things are. I'm not sure I can or should change. I feel self-conscious and selfish. I have to learn somehow to wait. Someday I may find my own successes, not dates and clothes, but good feelings about life, helping and giving, real love rather than popularity. These are hard times, though. Waiting isn't easy. Help me. And I wrote the book just before my high school class reunion. I think it was the 20th. I was sitting around thinking, I don't know, I dreamed about that reunion, and I began to think about what it was like. You know, I think we all just immediately transfer back to those days when we anticipate going to that reunion and lose all our self-confidence. Everybody tries to lose all the weight we can, you know, all that stuff. That's when I realized I was still very much in touch with those feelings. My parents mean well, and they want to help me. They want the best for me. I'm sure they love me, but my parents don't understand. They see me through the eyes of their teenage years. Things are different now. Kids today have new problems. I try to tell my parents how I feel, but sometimes I can't. I end up not talking or else shouting or being sarcastic. Lord, I don't want to hurt them, but I have to be myself. Help my parents realize that I can't always be like them. I can't tell them everything I do or say or think. Help me too, Lord. Keep me from being unkind when I talk with them. And help me be a little more patient. My parents mean well. Maybe I can find ways to help them understand. Struggle, the struggle of adolescence. As I said, I wouldn't return. Throughout all those years, however, there was a struggle going on within our whole family, and the struggle was alcohol. My dad was an alcoholic, and absolutely everybody is affected by that. And so it wasn't always as good as it may have sounded there in those first few poems. But it did cause me at a later time to be able to write about it and perhaps help other people. I hate holidays, family gatherings, false calm, meaningless conversation, tense smiles. All the while a thunderhead hovers over everyone, waiting for a word, a gesture, a mysterious mistake to ignite the great explosion, and you will drink again. you do begin to live as if that is in control of your life, because it is in many respects for everyone. I always thought we were a normal family. I've begun to look at other families and compare them with our own. We're different. Something's missing. Openness, honesty, feelings. We don't live naturally as they do. We're unpredictable and cautious, unsure of each other. I wish we felt free to hug and laugh, talk and be ourselves and tell the truth. I wish we knew what it is to be a family. In a sense, this book is best designed for people in Al-Anon and friends of people who have a drinking problem. I drove hundreds of miles in blind rescue attempts, bringing you home from the tavern, picking you up at the center, driving you to the celebration because we weren't sure you'd be well enough to drive. I called to make excuses, too sick to come, unexpected guests. I tried to explain what would make you act this way, how your past and present caused you to feel as you did. I went to work, cared for your health, cleaned up after you, and paid your bills. I did all this because I thought you needed me. I couldn't stand to see you suffering. You were feeling unloved, insecure. My need to ease your tension was as great as your need to escape or lean. Now I realize that in all those rescue attempts, I never let you take charge of your own mistakes. My rescues kept you drowning. When I ceased the rescue, you began to swim. I went to college at the University of Minnesota. I'm glad I went to school there. Many friends went to, say, Gustavus Adolphus and so on. But I'm kind of glad I went to the Big U. And I graduated in education. And at the end of that time, met my husband-to-be. Actually, I met his brother first. He was a good friend of mine. I can remember the first night I went to the house after going out with Butch was his name, the man I married, John. And going over to the house afterwards, and his dad, tongue-in-cheek, looked at me and said, "Oh, yes, didn't I meet you with Tom?" His brother. And the whole family went, "Dad!" I love that dad. He's been a good dad to me. This book is about being newly married. Other people smile when we act silly. Perhaps they've forgotten how much fun it is to laugh at each other and enjoy being together, childlike. I pray we'll always cherish this magic. But I wanted to be realistic in the book. I wanted to talk about all those parts of marriage, especially in a first year. I can remember one friend saying that she never cried so much as she did the first year that she was married. And that's the start of one of the poems. I never cried so much or so often or whatever it was. Fury, barbed wire mentality. I hated the sound of my voice, screaming at you with my selfishness and quavering in disappointment as you retaliated. Why did we allow our feelings to overrule our promise to try to hear and understand? The pain as we retrace our fence and mend the damage is a poignant reminder of our foolish haste and need to win. I'm sorry. Oh, I put down, maybe I'll share that then. It seems to me I've never cried so often or so hard. I have a driving need to find a way for us to live together without destroying me or you. But when it's hard, I cry. I think it's a sign that I care. Pictures are kind of nice because the photographer was, as a real artist, I think, took the poems and put pictures, whether they were pictures of nature or people, beside them. Well, John and I were married in 1962. He was on internship that year in Hartford, Connecticut, so that was our first home. Then we moved back to Minneapolis, and after I taught for another few years, we had our first child, whose name is Ted. And some of you have seen or met him. He just came back from a trip to Japan. It was a very exciting day when I left Holden. I mean, I was kind of all engrossed in this last week because I went out to meet him in Seattle when he flew in from Japan. But when he was very small, one thing was the same. He was as energetic then as he is now. And he became ill at one point. He was almost 2 years old, and he had a bout with pneumonia. And all of a sudden, he was just changed, you know? The happy, cheerful child was quiet. And it was scary. I drove him down to the doctor. I was scared to death. And I composed this on the way to the doctor. I'm pretty sure that time I didn't write it in the car. A lot of times I used to do that. Ooh. But that day, I was just so aware of his lethargy. But it reminded me of the opposite. My child, a little sparrow, hops up beside me, chirping, chirping, snuggling in a nest of love which I would have protect him, bobbing in delight to see the sunlight of the day, fluttering his frail wings as he tries to reach new heights, proud, undaunted, unafraid, coy and cheerful, swooping down in mischief, mingling his laughter with my own. My little sparrow, my sheer delight. Thank goodness he got well. And his brother grew into the poem, because Michael was very much the mischief maker swooping down. He now, of course, is 16. Michael's an adopted child, so we had two experiences there. What a wonderful little boy he is. He loves life. Sand, snow, books and music, anger, teasing and hugs, and laughter. He rejoices in it all. He lifts my spirits to a beautiful vista where living becomes adventure. How I love this dear child of yours. Thank you for giving him to us. We will try to care for all his needs, to feed his curiosity, to stretch his sensitivity, to discipline his self-will, to love him and love him and allow him to be. The responsibility is so great, but thank you for this wonderful experience. Being a mother was something I loved, still do. Well, it's easier sometimes than others. But I've enjoyed the boys, I think, pretty much all the way through, no matter what the struggles have been. And to watch them becoming independent now is a very joyous time for me. At the time that they were small, we lived in a suburb of Minneapolis called Robbinsdale. And then we had to move. It was our first move from a parish, which is, I think, probably the most painful one. Very hard to leave those friends, even though we stayed in the same basic area. It took me a good year, I think, to adjust to the new place. Probably you have to go through every season once before you feel familiar. And one day I'd been at a mother-daughter banquet, and I was walking out the door, and here was a friend. Well, I suddenly realized she was a friend. She had been there during that year, and I had become acquainted with her, and it suddenly just sort of came over me that I had now a friend in this new place. God, I walked through the door, saw her coming, and I felt good. I felt glad. There's a beautiful aura to friendships, a warm, close feeling one has when one is in harmony with another. You've given us friends to keep us living. Sympathy, they say, is necessary to renew the spirit. Thank you for the sympathy of friends. Honesty builds strength and makes growing possible. Thank you for their honesty. Love takes many forms and endures. Thank you for their love. In a last-minute offer to babysit when I had a chance to get away. In a phone call offering to bring dessert when she knew I was lonesome. In a bolstering of my spirit by saying, well done. In a reassuring hand, reaching to squeeze mine among the crowd. Thank you for the love of friends, akin to the love of Christ, which surpasses all understanding and gives us reason to live. God bless my friends. Parenting has those many stages. If you heard Cammy this morning, that was a very good presentation. And when they were little was, in some ways, the hardest stage for me. Everyone has the little different points of view on that. And this book was written prior to their growing up. But I guess I could see it coming and wrote this. Father, this is a difficult time. My children are drawing away from me. Daughters no longer tell all their secrets. Sons avoid my touching them. When I ask questions, I hear, "Oh, Mom." I feel left out, Lord. I used to sit and listen for what seemed hours to running accounts of a seventh grade class party, a new snow fort, the school play, a cute boy, and a basketball scrimmage. Sometimes all I hear these days is, "We just went to a movie, that's all." "Hi, Mom, who has the car tonight?" "I'd like to talk, Mom, but I'm going to be late getting to Mark's." I know they must build their own lives, but I miss them. I still need their affection. I still want to share their joys. I still want to be needed. Help me, Lord, to be understanding when they feel they must work things out alone, to recognize their need to feel independent, to build my life around things other than my children's activities and achievements. Help me to endure these years of withdrawing with patience and without prying, so that someday, when they feel independent and trusting, they will come again to me and ask, "Mom, can I talk to you about something?" That's sad. In those years, I guess I grew in a particular direction. First, in that getting to know people and wanting to be in dialogue with people, being open and honest, finding that to be a good way to live. And then in the area of being more global and more understanding of cooperation and the need to share and those kinds of things. Jesus, how often you've heard me say, "Children, share. You must learn to share your toys." But how sharing am I? Well, I never mind sharing my second best at rummage sales, garage sales, clothing appeals. But I don't always give away my preferential items, money in sums of noticeable sacrifice, the use of my properties, or my time. When it comes right down to it, we keep for ourselves our boats and cars, our power tools, our favorite recipes, our backyards, our tax monies from people in tax-poor areas, our churches from youth who might make it look lived in, our holiday tables from non-family members. We find sensible rationale for our reluctance to share. Maybe that's why children sometimes do not share. Maybe they are doing better than I. I remember how the rich young ruler went away from Jesus, sad. I think I understand why. Help me change. When Michael was in kindergarten, I began to work part-time outside the home, doing some educational work. It was hard for him. It was hard for him to adapt to that because he kind of liked to come home. He kind of didn't like to have to be with new people all the time. It's always been something Mike's felt. On the other hand, it was a very good thing for me, and so we had to kind of work that through. They say part-time employees are the most efficient. They are less likely to waste time at coffee breaks or long lunches. They tend to work hard and leave. Thanks for this part-time job, Lord. I like being home with my family, and I also like working outside our home. I appreciate an economy where this is possible. I'm stimulated by the people I meet, and I enjoy sharing these experiences with my family. I do work hard at my job and at home, and I enjoy both. Thank you, Lord. Help, I need a day off. I work at my job, in the kitchen, in the yard, in the basement utility room. I never get time off. I'm responsible all the time, and I notice the areas where I slip. Fewer nice dinners, missing children's sports events, weeds in the garden, cobwebs in the den. Part of working outside the home is this sense of unending responsibility. But I may be overreacting today. I have more help from my family than I used to. My garden isn't perfect, but it's all right. The family hardly has time for big dinners on weekdays anyway. And now that I think of it, the cobwebs were there before I started working outside the home. And what's wrong with allowing myself a little free time to play tennis or read a book? It does me good to relax. I'm sorry, Lord, I expected too much of myself. I was trying to be self-sufficient, all-powerful and perfect again. Forgive me. I've changed since I went to work. I was the one who'd been happy at home. I still am. I still like my family and my home. But I've added something to my life, confidence. I've tried more new experiences during my first months of working than I had tried for years previous. I had to travel alone. I learned to get around in unfamiliar areas. I developed skill and organization. I became more quickly sensitive to my children, their health, their quietness, their disappointments, because I needed to be perceptive. I didn't have time to wait to be told. I'm less self-centered. I appreciate friends and people who help me. I'm grateful for the surge of pleasure, the pride that comes when someone says that I have accomplished a task at work. These experiences cannot be taken away, whether I work for years or only for another week. I have grown because I have dared to try, dared to fail, and I made it. I altered my life plan, and I made it. Thank you, Lord, for giving me this opportunity to learn more about myself. To learn that about myself. And I know many women share that experience. Well, we all share that experience. We just would take a few more risks. We would discover so much more about life and ourselves. But all was not well at home, even though we had good times, and in some ways we had a very good family life. Our children were very important to us, and we did some fun things together. Even so, it was not smooth for John and for me. No matter what I'd been doing, it was always when I began to drive back home that my jaw clenched tight. I carried the weight of our relationship clutched in my head, my chest, and my arms. Finally, my teeth began to ache, and my stomach wouldn't welcome food. I hurt, my whole body hurt, from the tension of trying and trying and trying. My body knew it couldn't be done. Part of the books on mothering talk about that absolute need to be in communication with that partner with whom you share parenting. And John and I grew and grew and grew apart. And so it became necessary for us to be divorced. We promised a covenant in church for better, worse, richer, poor, sickness, health, until death. We broke the promise. Yet being together was death for both of us. We were no longer healthy. Today, we have another chance to live again. Still, it's hard to break a promise. It's very hard. It was very hard to watch how that affects children. An old song takes me back. I remember all the moments, the happinesses, the fun of being together. I am again young in our relationship. I miss those days. I can't have them back, but I miss them. And when you're divorced, that's the way it is. forward and back for quite a period of time till you can kind of get settled into a new life. And I really never had regrets about what happened in the sense of having made a wrong decision. But one just does struggle all the time with how it has an impact on all those around you. I find myself reluctant to ask other people for help. A counselor, a sounding board, a hug on Sunday morning, a voice on a quiet night. Sometimes it's because I'm afraid, afraid to need people, and afraid to lose someone again. I lift my chin and argue with myself that I should stand alone. I keep going another week, another day. It'll get better eventually. And then one afternoon I know I cannot do it alone. I need someone to stand with me. My fear has robbed me of love, the very thing I hoped most to recover as I travel this changing road. Reach out, I tell myself. Tell someone what you need. We aren't created to stand alone. It's a hard thing to do, but that is exactly what I had done at times, was repeat the marriage problem, which was we didn't talk. And to do that and not reach out to other people would have been just the same problem. But I learned that now. I really did learn it. I'm glad about that. One doesn't travel through life and know people and experience things without observing, I think, what's going on around us, I hope. This has been a throwaway world. Disposable diapers, tableware, cups, shavers, dressing gowns, pop cans, bed pans, tissues, cast-offs creating landfills, landfills of luxury. Soon it became pervasive, cast-off people, disposable values, replaceable nature. Shall we yet throw away all that we hold dear? Or shall we cling to lasting, life-giving values? People, love, sharing, earth, God. The name of this book is Help Me Adapt, Lord. Hunger. What do I know of hunger? Temporary pangs between meals. Hunger saps strength, energy, brain power, the will to live. Lord, it is a sin that your creatures, any of them, should lack the will to live, your great gift, because they're hungry while others are overfed. Even though grocery prices are higher, I am fed. There are things I can do and learn to change this world, to feed the many, to share. But it's a complicated job, and so I delay or deny or idly hope. The job, the people, wait for me. Lord, we do not lack the strength. We lack the will. And somehow moving from that thing with grandma into raising children and then moving out of that stage now, the continuity continues. That what I am doing, and whether I have opinions on world hunger or on disposable things, has something to do with the fact that I have children and they have children. I want to teach my children lasting values: Christian, caring, unselfish, kind. I am impatient when they beg for more things or leave lights burning. How do I persuade children, present-day people, that tomorrow will reflect today? That blessed people are to be good stewards? That people are more important than things? I teach them by example, buying less or delaying purchases, repairing, recycling. Contrasting profit with people motives. Spending time with them, playing games. Rejoicing in what we have rather than complaining about our lack. I must expect no more of them than I expect of myself. The last one. This little tiny book called Facing Up was published by Fortress Press in 1980. And in some ways, I like it best. I guess they're all introspective, but this is sort of more so. And they're all real short, people like that. Unfortunately, it's not on the market anymore, but it sort of tries to look at ourselves realistically. Laugh at ourselves and not take ourselves so seriously, perhaps. Aging is for other people, except now and then when I can't run the stairs. Gray hairs bother me, but I feel just like I did when I was 20. I feel young. I have to feel young. There isn't an ad on television that doesn't suggest I should be young. If I admit I'm aging, then I must acknowledge I'm dying. I'll die someday. But not yet, Lord, not so soon. I'd rather pretend I'll be young forever. Help me be more honest. Life is the good gift, and aging is the process of living. The gray hairs really don't bother me. I'm kind of used to them now. Passing by the item in the store was difficult because it was on sale. Clearance. It grew large before me. All its uses, the beautiful colors, the unique design, and my desire to have, possess, acquire, purchase, grew to an emotion-charged pitch. I approached the sales clerk only to discover I could have two for even more savings. Two! I began to plot how I could use two, where I could store them, who I could tell, and to compliment myself on thrift and wisdom, being in the right place at the right time. Suddenly I knew. Wrong place, wrong time. I didn't really need one, certainly not two. I was trapped in bondage in a free country to the desire to have more and more, to satisfy emotions rather than needs. Wisdom was really my wanting, and my thrift was simple greed. I walked away. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong reasons, wrong God. And the longer we live, the more we realize that it isn't all neat and tidy, this life of ours. It doesn't all fit together so well. And maybe our only hope is that beyond this life, things fit together, because they never will. I know, I just keep thinking, well, I got through that one now. I certainly was feeling that about graduation from seminary. I got through that one. You know, then I realized, oh boy, what's ahead of me? What do you think, Gwen? Should I go for it? He's a pastor. Life is full of unfinished things, dangling participles, separation, vague memories, and a yearning to tell those we cannot find that we're sorry. The puzzle is never complete because we're part of the human condition. We're not able to finish everything neatly, but we are able to be part of the picture, knowing, Lord, that you have seen it through. We are created to be together. From the start, we have been linked to others, conceived by two, loved by many, and invisibly part of a far-reaching world of humanness. We are bound together, sharing the tears of the hungry, the dances of children, the frustrations of the oppressed, and the fallibility of each, of all. We cannot make all things good. Yet together we can share, learn, care, work to change, and contribute to a growing good, blessed by God. We can be part of God's plan together. As you listen, perhaps you have identified, maybe not with the events, but with some sense of the experiences that I've shared, because I think there's so many universals to our lives. Our problem is we don't talk about them enough and find out how much we are alike rather than different. We are, after all, only human beings, creatures. And the more we can stay in touch with that, I think the more in relationship we will be with God. I'm confused. Sometimes I feel very strong, powerful, independent. I make good decisions. I lead other people. I sing. Other times I feel small, a tiny creature walking on a huge planet. Small steps, mistakes, weariness, fear. I create and try, but then I hesitate and hold back. I assure a friend, but also weep at my disappointment. I give up on life, but I also smile. In all this, I sometimes categorize my feelings and choices, good, bad. The fact, though, is I'm human. I'm not consistent, but I search to grow through any experience, to discover some little truth about life that will refill me and help me go on. I do not search alone. You are there, Lord. You know. You have felt, too. You understand. So that's my journey. I'm kind of hoping I won't have to have a big trauma in order to write another book. On the other hand, it seems to me that life is wonderful. And it's not just because we're away from it here, you know, and in this wonderful place at Holden Village. It's because everything about life is a gift. Even all of that despair, and I assure you that I know what that is. To be in despair. But even then, somehow I knew not only that God was there, even when I could hardly believe it, and sometimes I don't believe it, quite frankly, it just isn't always in place, but even then there's a reason to live. And you see, that's that gift, that's that spark of divine life that's in us, for which we can praise God. Thank you.